Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! Did the CIA drug Paul Robeson? Today, part two of our report on MKUltra, a top-secret psychological warfare program used by the Central Intelligence Agency. Also, Cuba opens a trial against the United States for the government's involvement in the killing of thousands of its citizens through armed aggression and biological warfare. And over 120 demonstrators are arrested in San Francisco and Philadelphia demanding a new trial and medical attention from Mumia Abu-Jamal. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're learning more about the death of the white supremacist who's suspected in a two-state drive-by shooting rampage. Authorities now say Benjamin Smith shot himself once in the chin as he was being pursued by police in southern Illinois on Sunday night. And they say that as he struggled with officers, he shot himself twice more in the leg and the chest, slicing through several organs. The county coroner says he then bled to death. Smith was in a hijacked minivan, which he'd grabbed after ditching the blue Ford Taurus, from which he's believed to have opened fire at minorities in Illinois and Indiana over the weekend. 2 miles down the road from where he was stopped, a crowd of 2,000 had gathered for an Independence Day celebration. Up to 10,000 people demonstrated yesterday in a southern Serbian city after a technician interrupted local television service to demand the ouster of a ruling party official. The protest in Leskovac, 120 miles southeast of Belgrade, was a further sign of growing discontent with the government of President Slobodan Milosevic. Milosevic has so far ignored the increasing calls for his ouster. The influential Serbian Orthodox Church and some prominent individuals also have demanded that Milosevic step down. Meanwhile, in Brussels, NATO says a lawmaker in the Bosnian Serb Assembly who's been indicted for war crimes is being taken to the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. NATO Secretary General Javier Solana says the detention of the lawmaker, Radoslav Bradanin, will contribute to the continued consolidation of the peace in Bosnia. 84 Bosnian Serbs, Croats, and Muslims have been publicly indicted on war crimes charges. 25 suspects are in custody in The Hague. 7 have been convicted, 1 acquitted. In Geneva yesterday, a UN body appealed to private companies to invest directly in Africa and promised to focus on the continent in a crusade against poverty. The UN Economic and Social Council offered a draft program for direct foreign investment to Africa, but released no specifics on how to achieve its long-term goal, eliminating poverty. Meanwhile, South African protesters were lashing out at Vice President Gore over the high cost of AIDS drugs. About 300 demonstrators marched outside the U.S. consulate in South Africa today. They accuse Gore of taking money from drug companies. It stems from a trade dispute. South Africa wants to import cheaper AIDS drugs from other countries or make its own generic versions. A law that would allow it to do that has been held up by a legal challenge from drug companies. The U.S. government has threatened trade restrictions if South Africa doesn't change the law. More than 3 million South Africans are HIV positive. In the third major attack since Turkey sentenced Kurdish rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan to death, a suicide bomber blew herself up outside a police station, injuring 17 others. The assailant, identified as a 19-year-old woman, flashed the V for Victory sign Monday before detonating the bomb strapped to her body, killing herself. The Anatolia News Agency said she was a Kurdish rebel wanted by security forces. The environmental group Greenpeace says global warming is threatening the world's coral reefs. A report out today from Greenpeace Australia says global warming is fueling the spread of a damaging condition known as coral bleaching, when coral gets stressed and expels the plant life that gives it color. Industrial pollution and the El Nino weather pattern are partially blamed for the problem. Scientists say at current rates, coral reefs could be gone from most of the world's oceans in another century. Large amounts of food and medicine arriving in Iraq under a UN-sponsored oil for food program are substandard, damaged, or unusable, this according to a top UN official. Iraq is under an oil embargo and other economic sanctions imposed after the country invaded Kuwait in 1990. The UN program allows the nation to export $5.2 billion in oil every 6 months and use the money to buy food and humanitarian goods. The program's executive director told reporters after a three-week tour of the country that many of Baghdad's complaints about the deal were legitimate. The previous director of the oil for food program quit because he said the situation was extremely harmful to the people of Iraq. That's some of the news. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Over 120 activists were arrested this Saturday in Philadelphia and San Francisco. They were demonstrating because they were demanding a new trial and medical attention for African-American journalist and death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. In Philadelphia, among those arrested was the Reverend Lucius Walker, who heads up Pastors for Peace. We spoke to him last week on Democracy Now! South African poet laureate Dennis Brutus joined with hundreds of protesters who gathered around Philadelphia's Liberty Bell on this July 4th weekend. These were a series of worldwide demonstrations on behalf of Mumia Abu-Jamal and against capital punishment in the United States. This past October, Pennsylvania's Supreme Court denied Abu-Jamal's bid for a new trial. For an update on the protests this weekend, we're joined by Bob Lederer. He's a member of ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, which is one of the endorsing groups in the protest. And he was one of those who engaged in civil disobedience at the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia on Saturday. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bob.
Good morning, Amy.
Can you tell us what the scene was like in Philadelphia?
Sure. This was perhaps one of the most exciting demonstrations I've been involved in. There were a total of 95 people organized into 16 affinity groups, which are the small units of people who develop their own specific plan to take a piece of the action and make it successful. And all of these 95 people went after a particular part of the pavilion holding the Liberty Bell, the goal being to disrupt business as usual on one of the highest tourism weekends at this historic landmark, and get out the message loud and clear to the public about the injustice in Mumia's case. And what we were able to do was to totally shut down the building and the ability of tourists to go in for the entire afternoon. And there were some very creative tactics used to do that. I was one of about three affinity groups. My group, which was lesbians, gay men, and bisexuals, we called ourselves the Simon and Coley Queer Crusaders for Mumia, named after the late gay South African anti-apartheid fighter who himself was given the death penalty, and then a massive campaign saved him. We blocked one of the doors. Several people chained themselves to the doors so that no one could get in. And then we had a really, really strong presence by several different groups working together in front of those doors. Other groups went after the other entrance. And then a group of students jumped up on the ledge over the top of the building, unfurled a banner saying "Liberty for Mumia." And meanwhile, just before the start of the action, several people went inside the building, went right up next to the bell itself, and unfurled another banner. I was told there was a very moving moment when a blind man was involved in that action inside, and he felt the bell with his hands before pulling out his sign calling for liberty for Mumia. And in addition, there were people who improvised at the moment when they were blocked by police from going where they wanted to go. They simply sat down in front of the police van, which was attempting to take those of us away who had already been arrested. And so altogether, as I said, 95 people arrested. We were held for between 7 and 9 hours and released with a minor charge of failing to obey a lawful order, and are now facing $250 fines per person, which we will be challenging in court.
I understand at the time the mayor was honoring the president of South Korea.
Well, that was actually the next day. There was in one of the classic ironies of the rhetoric versus the reality of the U.S. government, there was he was being honored as a former political prisoner, which is just exactly what Mumia Abu-Jamal is, and yet, of course, with no acknowledgement that the same Philadelphia government has put everything it can into the prosecution and conviction of a political prisoner right in their own home.
Finally, Bob Lederer, the San Francisco protests that took place, well, on Saturday as well.
Right. There were hundreds of people marched from the federal building to Union Square, and there 27 activists blocked the street and were arrested. And I should say, in Providence, Rhode Island, there was also a coordinated prayer vigil by the Synod of the United Church of Christ, which is both against the death penalty and calling for a new trial for Mumia Abu-Jamal. So there was solidarity in three cities and a really, really broad array of peace, black liberation, Puerto Rican independence, AIDS, lesbian, gay, and student groups that were involved in making the demonstrations on both coasts have a real impact. And in fact, we're already seeing tremendous media coverage of certainly of the Philadelphia action.
Well, Bob Lederer, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Bob Lederer, one of the more than 120 protesters who were arrested this weekend protesting the continued incarceration of Mumia Abu-Jamal, death row prisoner in Pennsylvania. And if you want more information on the case, there is a website at www.mumia.org. That's www.mumia.org. Well, today on Democracy Now!, as we move on to our next segment, we're going to bring you part two of our discussion with Paul Robeson Jr., son of the singer, actor, and activist Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson Jr. now believes that the Central Intelligence Agency was involved with drugging his father with a mind-altering drug, perhaps BZ. In the 1950s, in the midst of the Cold War, the Central Intelligence Agency developed a top-secret psychological warfare program called MKUltra. After the Second World War, the Western intelligence community became interested in the use of mind-control drugs when it was learned that Nazi scientists engaged in similar experimentation. Described as the CIA's version of the Manhattan Project, MKUltra was developed in response to rumors that the Soviets planned to plant brainwashed assassins in the White House and other citadels of Western power. Well, last week on Democracy Now!, Paul Robeson Jr. spoke about a doctor that treated his father, who had links to U.S. intelligence and British intelligence. Paul Robeson Jr. joins us again today to continue the discussion. We'll also talk with an expert in psychological warfare who can shed light on the possible role that U.S. and British intelligence may have played in the drugging of Paul Robeson Sr. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Paul Robeson.
Nice to be here, Amy.
Well, for listeners who perhaps missed Thursday's Democracy Now!, and I encourage people to go to the web for that show or any Democracy Now! If you miss it, you can simply go to www.pacifica.org and click on any Democracy Now! But can you summarize what happened to your father in the early 1960s in Moscow, which basically you feel was the evidence that your father was drugged?
Well, there's a context and a series of sets of evidences in various places. The first is Moscow, 1961. The context was that my father had decided to violate his passport regulations, visit China, return to the U.S. to join the civil rights movement, which was burgeoning. And on the way, he intended to visit Fidel Castro in Cuba. He had been invited by Fidel Castro. I know the details of that because I was the contact for the Cubans in the U.S. and was part of the arrangements. I and my father were both, so were the Cubans, very much concerned with security problems, so there would be no leak about his specific travel plans.
This was right before the Bay of Pigs invasion?
Yes. So that he, being in London, decided to just pull up stakes suddenly, get to Moscow and make his plans to go to China. And he wanted to go, by the way, to Africa and India as well, but his main targets were to go to China and then to Cuba and then home. He felt security-wise, obviously, Moscow was a much better place to make those arrangements than London, where he felt that U.S. and British intelligence would be all over him. From Freedom of Information Act documents I've obtained, they were. Apparently, there was a leak in London, and the CIA, through the FBI attaché, legal attaché in London, did find out his travel plans. Since the Bay of Pigs was scheduled for April 17th and he departed from Moscow on March 23rd, there was kind of a panic in the CIA to help from the documents. There was, of course, a motive for them to neutralize him in Moscow so he wouldn't go to Cuba and be there when the Bay of Pigs invasion occurred. So that's the context. He went to Moscow. If you saw the two-hour feature documentary that was aired on American Masters on February 24th.
That's PBS.
PBS, right. He was quite active from March 23rd on. I mean, he appeared at meetings, he sang, he spoke. There was no trace of any depression or any problem. Suddenly, on the night of March 26th, in the context of a unscheduled and suspicious wild party in his quarters, which he locked himself away from in an inner room, he was discovered the next morning with his wrists slashed. So my suspicion was that he was drugged at the party with probably LSD, because he hallucinated immensely. And in a day and a half, he was more or less back to normal, which is the symptoms of LSD rather than BZ. His description of the party, there were a lot of suspicious kind of people there, meaning anti-Soviet people who were talking about, would you help me get my relatives out of the gulag, things like that. Very disconnected, not normal for, here's a distinguished visitor, Paul Robeson in Moscow, and these people around in the party. Anyway, long story short, excuse me, I made my own investigation. I was fluent and still am in Russian, had a lot of contacts there. The Russian officials were very embarrassed by what happened. Evidently, there was no appropriate security. The party, they didn't know about any more than I did. I asked them specific questions. Did they test his blood for drugs? They couldn't answer those questions. Very peculiar set of circumstances. They advised me, this is a very strange time in Moscow. We'd advise you don't continue your investigation. We can't really help you. Better for your health if you lay off. I ignored that warning. 3 days later, I had a similar experience. I was hallucinating extraordinarily. Long story short, an LSD trip, recovered in a few days.
That you didn't take voluntarily.
Never had, definitely not, no. I never had any other psychological break before or after. This was 30-some years ago. Psychiatrists have told me there is no such natural phenomenon of a one-peak psychological problem, psychiatric problem. So I've concluded that there were two druggings with LSD, my father and me. One to neutralize us, and especially with me to discredit any investigatory activity that I did afterwards. That was fairly effective, so that's one of the reasons for all these years before I've come forward with more evidence. The post-Moscow issue is very important because he was treated at two hospitals, one in London and one here,
Paul,
at which he was, so to speak, zapped with electroshock.
When we come back from our break, we're going to learn about that, and we'll be joined by a person who studied British intelligence. And interestingly enough, in Odd Connections in the show, in the last segment, we'll go to Havana, Cuba, where the people of Cuba have brought suit against the U.S. government for the government's involvement in the killing of thousands of Cubans over the last 40 years through dirty tricks. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Paul Robeson Jr. in the studio as he describes what happened to his father and himself, actually, in the early 1960s, in 1961. In Moscow, he feels that his father was drugged at a party. I would ask why you think that the Russians wouldn't want this investigated, considering this was in the midst of the Cold War, and if there was any thought that the U.S. government was involved with the drugging of Paul Robeson, I would think the Russians would want to make that known.
Big problem, because there was a total security lapse. No KBG, KGB would want to say, well, yeah, sure, they hit Paul Robeson, Paul Robeson Jr. under our noses in Moscow. Also, there may have been some Russian official or officials involved. It was a very complicated situation there.
Well, let's move from there to you and your mother coming and bringing your father to the Priory Hospital in London.
That's not how it happened. In fact, the Soviet doctors said the place for him is home, where his roots are. He's safest there, too. And that was his idea. He's safer in the United States, even under the noses of the CIA in a black community, than wandering around Europe. They also said he should go back without a stop anywhere else. He would be probably more comfortable, is the way they put it. My thought was, if they did zap him in Moscow, he shouldn't be wandering around London. By a series of circumstances, which, you know, it's a fairly long story. Not only that, they said the one thing that he should not get, this is an anxiety, kind of schizophrenic symptom, so on, shock treatment would be criminal. I mean, they went as far as doctors didn't use the word criminal, but outrageous. No heavy drugs, no up or down, or the kind of thing you do for chronic depression. It's a different, so they do that a lot in England, take him back to the U.S. By a series of circumstances, I went home early, and since I had had a, quote, breakdown, they wouldn't release Dad with me to go directly home. Well, that was a downside of having gotten this, I feel, drugging. Long story short, he wound up in London on his way back to the United States, just what the Soviets and I suggested shouldn't happen. And within a week, he was disoriented, came back to the Soviet Union, was fine. Second time around, again, not direct to the U.S., back to, and within 36 hours, somehow, well, not somehow, he was signed into the Priory by a doctor whom I subsequently interviewed and am very suspicious of. So he landed in the Priory under strange circumstances. There he got 54 electroshock treatments without my knowledge.
How did he get them without your knowledge?
Well, again, a long story. They convinced my mother, who was then, you know, beginning to die of cancer, that his only hope was electroshock, that I was all upset, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, they convinced her to give him to sign off on the shock treatments and not tell me. When I found out, I mobilized a group here and in England to get him out to East Berlin, the Buch Clinic. Just in time, they were going to give him another series of electroshock treatments, more powerful.
So he remained in the Priory Hospital for how long?
Just under 2 years.
And you've just recently received the documents from the Priory Hospital.
I got the Priory. And the reason I mobilized the group to get him out is that somebody from England visiting the U.S. told me he was getting shock treatments. Hmm. So within 48 hours, I did something about it.
We're talking to Paul Robeson Jr. We're also joined on the telephone by Mike Minichino, who is an MKUltra historian and looks specifically at British intelligence. And we want to see how the Priory Hospital fits into British intelligence. But first, Mike Minichino, welcome to Democracy Now!
How are you, Amy?
Good.
How are you, Mike?
Hi.
Paul here.
Hi, Paul.
Yeah.
Let's start with you just summarizing the MKUltra program. Again, it's not proved at this point that Paul Robeson Sr. was a target of it, but describe MKUltra.
Well, very briefly, MKUltra is the code name, one of the code names of several projects that started right after World War II, before the CIA was formed, and continued in full force nominally until the middle of the 1960s. MKUltra was a project, in effect, to develop techniques of both individual and mass social control that would use not only drugs, but also hypnosis. In the mandate, it says sociology, anthropology, all kinds of different things in order to develop these things. What happened was that, as you said, after the war, there was a great deal of fear. It wasn't so much fear of what the Nazis had done at the Dachau concentration camp. What really threw everybody for a loop was the Cardinal Mincenti so-called brainwashing in the early 1950s. Excuse me, was that 49? I can't even remember.
What was that?
The Cardinal Mincenti in Hungary. He was a Roman Catholic cardinal who was arrested and then confessed to being an agent of the West in what many people thought was a show trial. It was considered at the time that he had been given some regimen of drugs and hypnosis, and that it had made this a cardinal, a Roman Catholic cardinal, denounce everybody and completely transform his personality. This, we know, the highest levels of American intelligence and British intelligence totally flipped out at the possibilities of this. That plus some evidence from American POWs during the Korean War convinced American intelligence and British intelligence that there were operations going on in the Soviet Union. That's effectively the cover story. The real story behind that is that there were lots of people who were talking about developing techniques of mass social control. That now that the world was in rubble after World War II, we were going to rebuild it, and the best way to rebuild it would be on more scientific lines. And that if psychiatrists and sociologists and psychologists could use the techniques that they began to develop during World War II, that potential problems, potential troublemakers could be identified early on in the system. That everybody would be, as they used to say in the 50s, well-adjusted. And they wouldn't have really any major problems. And there's lots of documentation both from Britain and from the United States of people saying, look, psychiatrists should be allowed to rule in their own name, and we'll make the world a better place. Perhaps the best thing in the world is when, and we'll give you a sense of this, there was a new dealer named A.A. Burrell, Adolf Burrell, which many people may know. He was asked to become the chairman of the board of a dummy corporation called the Human Ecology Fund. This was the primary agency that the CIA and others used to fund MKUltra experiments covertly. When he was given a pro forma briefing on the project. He was not directly involved, but he was going to be the front man. And they gave him a background briefing. That night, after that briefing, he went to his diary, and he wrote the following entry in the diary. And this is his upon hearing what MKUltra was about. And he said, and I quote, "I am frightened by this one. If the scientists do what they have laid out for themselves, men will become manageable ants." And that's what MKUltra was.
Now talk about the Priory Hospital.
Priory, the key thing about the Priory is that it's one of the hospitals which is connected to the Maudsley hospital system. Maudsley is one of the old venerable hospitals in London. It is the primary psychiatric care hospital. The Priory, if I'm not mistaken, and Paul might be able to correct me on this, is a subdivision of that network, that hospital network. The psychiatric leader at Maudsley is a guy named William Sargent, who was a top brainwasher for British intelligence at the time. And he is the guy who was developing, with places like the Tavistock Institute in London, many of the techniques that were, in fact, used on Paul Robeson. That is to say, massive, what's called Paget-Thompson. Is it Paget? I can't remember. It's a specific form of Paget-Russell, I believe. Electroshock, which completely disorients, the kind of thing that happened to Robeson. Sargent As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, Amy, you had Eric Olson on your show last week?
Yes, Eric Olson, the son of Frank Olson.
Right.
Who was a government scientist who himself was slipped a drug by the U.S. government. Ultimately, the government has settled with him, even though he was studying this, and he ended up either jumping out of a Manhattan hotel window or being pushed.
Eric and some people that we are working with in London is very close to proving that the reason why his father was given the treatment that ultimately led to his death by one means or another was in fact because he was in London talking to William Sargent, complaining about exactly the kinds of things that he was involved in. Frank Olson was involved in MKUltra, and he, just like A.A. Burrell, was very freaked, it appears, at what he was actually seeing the project was doing. And he complained to several people in London, including William Sargent. And when he came back, he was given the treatment. So we're developing the case that Sargent is, in fact, the guy who signed the death sentence on Eric Olson's father, Frank Olson, who died in 1953, on circumstances which are actually similar to the kind of drugging that Paul Sr. and Jr. went through.
Mike Minichino, who is an MKUltra historian and also looks at British intelligence. Paul Robeson, you have a number of documents in front of you. You have the Priory Hospital documents, but also FBI documents. What records did the U.S. government have on your father, Paul Robeson Sr.'s health?
Well, they had an unusual file, not standard, called Status of Health File. That file, excuse me, has a number of entries, some of them quite interesting. One dated April 7th, 1961. That's 2 weeks after my father, I think, was drugged, in any case, after his suicide attempt. In view of past exploitation of Robeson's popularity by the communists to further their aims, it is expected that the death of Robeson would be much publicized and that his name in past history would be highlighted, etc., etc. July 21st,
it reminds me of Hoover being afraid of black messiahs rising.
Right. It says on this FBI document, information regarding Robeson's status of health previously furnished to the state, that's the Department of State, the CIA, the Attorney General, and the White House under top secret classification. Not only is there a file, but right around this time, to the White House, all these places under top secret classification.
Now, this is under President Kennedy.
Under Kennedy's. It's not all as bad Republicans. And bear in mind, under Kennedy, there was an extremely conservative faction dominating the CIA, and I am one of those who think that the rogue elements in the CIA were involved in President Kennedy's assassination, but that's a whole other subject. In any case, the people who were the extreme faction, the man who planned the Bay of Pigs, Richard Bissell, and who masterminded the Lumumba assassination, was at that time, March, April 1961, according to the CIA documents, in charge of the Paul Robeson file. In addition, another person involved in supervising that file was James Angleton, an extreme right-wing type head of the CIA's counterintelligence division. So the people planning the Bay of Pigs, overseeing operations, special operations, meaning assassinations, druggings, etc., were the same people planning the Bay of Pigs and supervising the Paul Robeson file at precisely that time. In addition, the State Department documents are numbered in order, and it's fascinating that the State Department documents covered my father's entire visit to Moscow in 61. There are 10 successive documents missing between the dates of March 26 and April 1st. The night of March 26 was when my father, I think, was drugged. So why this sudden gap? You can see the numbers, they stop right there and pick up 3 days after the drugging, 4 days after the drugging. Finally, when you talk about motive, the CIA and FBI was very concerned about Dad's return to the U.S. because in 1961, Martin Luther King and the movement he led, which was an independent movement, recall the NAACP under Wilkins was dragged into the civil rights movement kicking and screaming, did everything it could to undermine King. In fact, it is on the record that Roy Wilkins collaborated with the FBI in their efforts to undermine King. So here you have Martin Luther King and that movement in full cry. Malcolm X moving away from the Nation of Islam towards King, and Robeson returning. Their nightmare was the three of them, the three musketeers together. That's powerful. So there was an immensely strong motive for them to neutralize Dad. Last but not least, the documents that have been refused me by the CIA include things like dispatch dated April 7th, 1961, report dated September 21, 1961, report dated November 9, 1961, etc., etc. So there are reports right in that period that certainly would shed light on what the CIA was doing on the Robeson file. As to the British, the Priory, the documents, which I now have in full, speculate on after the first three series of shock treatments that had added up to 30-some, they commented, in effect, my God, we can't understand it. His memory still seems unimpaired. What the hell is this? Let's give him some more. Finally, after 54 shock treatments, I have a letter from a consultant which reads July 10th, 1963. Right about 2 weeks later, we got him out of there. He says, it's not quite clear what his problem is, but he seems to be improving slowly. As I mentioned to you, I think in the reasonably near future, it might be worth giving him a more concentrated, orthodox course of ECT, watching him carefully, etc., etc., in view of the slight confusion he showed during the February-March course that was given to him, meaning that the unusual, the special kind of courses is what they started to zap him with after the normal ones didn't produce the result they wanted, which you just heard Mike Minichino discuss.
If you people want to find out more information about your father's case and your investigation, is there a place they can call or go on the web?
There is. I've heard that the FBI has put large amounts of my father's, the Robeson file, on the web, and that it's now accessible. What people could do is spread the word about why doesn't the FBI and CIA open up the files, the Robeson files that have been denied up to now. I certainly am going to pursue that is to retrieve files that have been denied, and going through the system, I intend to go all the way up to the White House to demand that they open up the files.
You know, it's interesting. There's a Human Rights Information Act bill before Congress that the U.S. would open its files, FBI, CIA, etc., on U.S. Supported atrocities in Guatemala and Honduras. It sounds like we need one for right here at home.
And by the way, there are specific people involved. The Dr. Ackner, Brian Ackner, who treated my father, was in charge of the case at the Priory, taught at the Maudsley Hospital at that time. So he's definitely connected to Maudsley. It doesn't mean he did it, but to investigate the names of the people who treated Dad, Dr. Ackner is now deceased, but there are two doctors who treated my father here. That's a whole other story, one of whom is still alive. I intend to pursue that lead.
And we will keep our listeners updated on your investigation. Paul Robeson Jr. with us in the studio. Mike Minichino, MKUltra historian and an investigator into British intelligence. Thank you both for joining us. When we come back, we're going to Havana, Cuba for a precedent-setting trial that has opened this week. Stay with us here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Cuba opened an unusual precedent-setting trial yesterday. It's demanding $181 billion in damages from Washington for deaths and injuries it says it has suffered during 40 years of hostilities by the U.S. government and its Central Intelligence Agency. The suit is asking for compensation for the deaths of over 3,000 Cubans and injuries to more than 2,000 others as a result of, quote, sabotage, bombings, and other terrorist acts caused by hostile U.S. government policy toward Cuba since the 1959 Cuban Revolution. This includes direct and indirect aggression against Cuba, from the abortive Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961 to a 1997 bombing campaign against tourist sites in Cuba, which Havana says was masterminded by a U.S.-based Cuban exile group. Cuba also accuses the U.S. of using biological warfare against the Cuban people. Washington has not responded to the suit. The lawsuit appears to be a direct response to another suit in the United States in which a federal judge in Miami ordered Cuba to pay $187 million to the families of three Cuban exiles who were killed when their planes were shot down by Cuban military jets. Cuba says the exiles from the group Brothers to the Rescue were shot down because they'd violated Cuban airspace. Washington and Havana are embroiled in a legal battle over U.S. attempts to seize Cuban funds from telephone companies operating long-distance phone service between the two countries to pay the families. A lawyer who is attending the trial as an international observer is William Schaap. He is affiliated with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York and the National Lawyers Guild. He's also publisher of Covert Action Quarterly. This morning, just before he went off to the trial in Havana, Cuba, I had a chance to talk to him and asked him to describe what the trial is all about.
It's basically called the People of Cuba versus the Government of the United States of America, and I guess the closest analogy in our system to what it is a wrongful death and personal injury case raising all of the instances of Cuban citizens who've been either killed or injured by U.S. actions over the years since the revolution. Probably the closest analogy to it would be the case brought by the Brothers to the Rescue people in Miami, where they brought a wrongful death action against Cuba. The analogy isn't exactly precise, I think, because there's far more legitimacy to this case than that. But in this case, virtually all of the victims were just innocent citizens who were not involved in anything. The case, which I guess was quite a long time in preparing, has a lengthy complaint and then a huge annex of documentation starting with incidents going way back until right after the revolution in 1959. There's a lot of material about the sabotage and terrorism and bandit groups that were active in the early 60s in Cuba being trained and funded and armed by the CIA. There are sections about chemical and biological warfare against Cuba. There are sections about actual military actions, primarily the Bay of Pigs, but others as well. And there are sections about all the assassination attempts against Fidel Castro. But in what they're doing very, very specifically is concentrating on particular instances where innocent people were killed, and they have several thousand, I don't remember the exact number, but probably 4,000 or 5,000 actual individuals who died on account of these actions, in whose name the case is being brought, and then many thousands more who were injured in these same actions, and they've been having both what we would call expert witnesses and fact witnesses. In the former case, most of the witnesses are people who have studied these areas for many, many years, doing sort of summarizations of all the American campaigns against Cuba. And in the fact witness case, they range from people who were officials in charge of security at the time these things happened, down some of whom have been very poignant and moving, even when they're talking about things that happened 30 or 40 years ago. They just yesterday they had the mother of one of the literacy teachers who was murdered by the bandits out in a farming village in the early 60s when he was teaching a peasant family how to read and write, and they had the son of the peasant he was teaching at that time, who was also murdered by this group.
What was the group?
It's quite an amazing set of presentations.
What was the group?
Well, they basically just call them bandit groups here, but in the early 60s, there were probably a couple of hundred small groups in the countryside and in the mountains who were fighting against the revolution, sometimes just groups of three or four people, sometimes as many as 20 or 30 or 40 people. They were all being supplied by the United States. There were airdrops of weapons. People were trained in the States and infiltrated back in. And this particular campaign against Cuba sort of dwindled out and ended in the middle to late 60s. But in the early 60s, there were hundreds of these bands just roving around, making surprise attacks, killing people, occasionally doing sabotage-type actions and bombings, but mostly just trying to terrorize the ordinary people who were supporting the revolution.
We're talking to attorney Bill Schaap. He works with the Center for Constitutional Rights as the publisher of Covert Action Quarterly, and he is in Havana, Cuba, for a precedent-setting case that began yesterday, charging the U.S. government with exactly what crimes, Bill?
Well, as I said, it's although they tend to refer to it as a war crimes case, and the instances involved would all be war crimes, it's really what we would call a wrongful death case. It's specifically dealing with innocent Cubans who were killed by actions that were either directly run by the United States or were financed and armed and supervised by the United States.
Now, because you have been...
There are areas, huge areas, that it does not deal with because they are not susceptible to that same kind of direct proof of a particular individual dying. I mean, the blockade against the shipment of medicines to Cuba has incredible ramifications, but it's not that easy to quantify into individual victims like this is. There are some cases on that scale that are involved here, for example, in the biological warfare and the dengue fever epidemic in the early 80s that was initiated and by the United States, by the CIA, and there were hundreds of people who died from dengue fever in that biological warfare, and many, many thousands who were injured.
Can you explain that case?
Well, it was Cuba's been the victim of a lot of biological warfare from the United States, but most of it was directed at crops. I mean, there were many, many instances of the infiltration of tobacco rot, which ruined a lot of the crop here, of swine fever that killed a lot of the pig population. But the dengue fever epidemic in, I think it was 1981, was the first time that they used a human disease that directly attacked people. And it's carried by mosquitoes, although it was of a type of disease that was not found in Cuba at the time. And all of a sudden, in three or four different isolated places, cases of a very, very severe form of dengue fever broke out. And within weeks and months, there was an epidemic in the island. And as I said, hundreds and hundreds of people died, and tens of thousands were injured.
How was it directly traced?
It was overcome.
How was it directly traced to the United States?
Well, in this case, actually, there was a confession a few years later in a court proceeding where a Cuban exile who had been involved in planting some of the mosquitoes and delivering some of them admitted that they had gotten their material from the CIA. Now the CIA did not admit this, of course. There have been some instances where official government reports in the United States have admitted some of these actions. This one, however, there was really pretty overwhelming proof that it had to be biological warfare. It had to have come from the United States. And, in fact, as I said, there were a few people involved who admitted that that's where they were getting it from.
In what cases has the CIA admitted involvement?
Well, as many people may know, they certainly admitted some of the assassination attempts against Fidel. There was a whole report on that at the time of the Church Committee in the middle and late 70s. They admitted quite a few of the early actions to try to disrupt the revolution in 59, 60, 61, 62, that range. There were a large number of previously classified documents that were released in the States, minutes of meetings of the committees that started under the last months of the Eisenhower administration and continued into the Kennedy administration, planning various methods of sabotage, particularly economic sabotage, to try to destroy the economy. Of course, they have admitted their involvement in the Bay of Pigs, which was the largest operation in which many Cubans were killed.
Again, we're talking to Bill Shapp in Havana, Cuba. Bill, can you describe what the courtroom scene is like and who specifically has brought this case?
Well, they're using a room in the Council of State building because the case, which is brought, again, as a regular wrongful death case, was simply brought in the main trial court in Havana, the municipal court, and they didn't have any room quite large enough to deal with the crowd that's come for this one. So they're using a meeting room in the Council of State building, which is quite beautiful and elegant room, and has enough seats for a large audience. Technically, the case is brought in the name of the people of Cuba, but it's brought by eight different national organizations, which between them represent almost the entire population. It's brought one of the plaintiffs is the Central Trade Union, another is the National Association of Small Farmers, the Federation of Cuban Women is one, the Federation of University Students, the High School Federation, the Children's Organization, the Association of the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, and also an interesting one, the Association of Combatants of the Revolution, veterans of the actual fighting that took place just prior to the triumph of the revolution. So these eight organizations are the representative plaintiffs, and in fact, yesterday the president or the secretary or the head of each of these organizations was in court sitting in a large area where the plaintiffs would sit.
Will Fidel Castro be testifying?
I don't know. They're only giving the list of the witnesses each day that they expect to testify. The trial could go on for several weeks. It's sort of unclear to those of us that are observing. They had maybe 7 or 8 or 9 witnesses testified yesterday, and they really only were dealing with the very, very early years. I don't know that he would. It's hard to say. I mean, but it's probably unlikely because most of the witnesses are like eyewitnesses to murders and bombings and attacks like that, and I don't know that Fidel would have been an eyewitness to those things that were going on in the countryside.
Of course, he was a witness to assassination attempts against himself.
Yes, that's for sure. Although most of them never got quite that close to him. Most of them were thwarted some way down the line.
What were some of those?
But they do expect a lot of people who are sort of well-known in Cuba for the prominent roles they played in the early days to be testifying.
And what about the media? What kind of coverage is this getting?
Well, somewhat to my surprise, there was a fairly significant foreign media presence there for the opening yesterday. CNN was there, AP was there, Reuters was there, a number of European, the Spanish, German, French agencies were there. And whether it will, the coverage will appear in the United States is another question. I mean, of course, all the Cuban and a lot of Latin American media were here, but I was a little surprised to see the wire services and groups like CNN and AP television covering it. The problem, of course, is whether the agencies back home and the stations in the States will run anything about it. My suspicion all along, and I've been asked this by a lot of people down here, is my suspicion is that the strategy in the mainstream press in the States will probably be to try to ignore this if they can, and if they can't, then to simply belittle it. But, of course, it's another example of the incredible double standard that rules the media coverage in the States and the hypocrisy that entails.
Bill Schaff, an attorney who is acting as an international trial observer, is at an unprecedented trial in Cuba, the people of Cuba versus the government of the United States, demanding $181 billion in damages from Washington for deaths and injuries the Cuban government and people have suffered over the last 40 years. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you missed any part of the program, you can listen to us online at www.pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!